Welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast. My name is Shane Breslin and this is episode number 22 with Robin Grace. Robin Grace is someone I've met and got to know a little bit over the past year or so. And from a few minutes into our first conversation over the phone, I knew that I wanted to interview him about his work at some point for this podcast. Robin is a member of An Garda Síochána, which for anyone listening outside Ireland means he's a policeman. He's also the founder of a startup aimed at improving online safety for young people. The Me app is a safety-first social networking app that connects young people in a meaningful way with the people who care most about them, particularly in a time of need. Robin has launched a new Kickstarter campaign which aims to raise the €75,000 needed to develop and bring to market the Me app over the next few months. Robin's motivations for online safety and suicide prevention comes both from his work as a Garda in the community, where he deals with issues like this all the time, and also from his own history of self-harm and suicidal intentions, which stemmed from abuse he suffered in his early childhood. Robin speaks candidly about all of that in this episode, of being hit by the freight train of trauma while traveling through India, to how close he came to taking his own life when a Facebook post initiated a sequence of events which led to a call from his mother, the one person he says he needed to hear from in that moment, and who did not have a Facebook account at the time, so couldn't have seen his cry for help. He also talks about the issue of technology use among teens and children, and why we need to adopt new methods of education and support rather than the self-defeating outright bans which can become the norm in schools and homes across the world. I do hope you enjoy this episode, and if Robin's vision for the Me app resonates with you, please do check out his Kickstarter campaign. I'll include a link to that in the show notes, so head on over to shanebreslin.com/pod22. That's shanebreslin.com/pod22 for all that those details. We also do talk about suicidal thoughts and suicidal ideation in this episode, so if you are having a difficult time or you are supporting somebody that's having a difficult time, please do reach out and have a conversation. I do recommend talking to the Samaritans, available in Ireland and the UK for free 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on the phone number 116 123. That's 116 123 to reach a Samaritans volunteer. Without further ado, on to this week's episode and my interview with Garda and founder of the Me app, Robin Grace. Robin, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here, Shane.
This is the first time we've met in person, but we've spoken quite a bit over the last, probably about a year.
Correct.
Through a mutual contact that introduced us. I think you two guys should know each other.
It was
Justin.
It was,
And so I'm looking forward to exploring this. I know that you're working on some interesting things. I think that it's fair to say, well, I would surmise that you have a very, even a unique perspective on things. I think we all have unique perspectives, but your background and where you are now and what you're working on is something that struck me as not unusual but unique, really, when we got talking and we got to meet each other. But before we delve into all that, give the listeners a sense of, you know, who Robin Grace is, where you are in life, what brought you here.
We all have a story, and I suppose a story starts at the beginning, but what I will say is that growing up I was very creative, but always a thinker, always asking why. My family will get a kick out of that. Like my biggest and most important thing to know when I was a kid was why. Didn't really excel in school, but I went on and I studied photography, worked as a press photographer for a while. But then my father became sick and I took a break and went traveling across Asia and Africa for almost a year. And then when I came back, I started studying sociology, politics and human rights. And after that, I spent a bit of time unemployed. But my motivation in my adult life is I really like meeting people and helping them as much as I can. And when the guards started hiring again in 2014 and 15, I applied, and all my friends and family thought it was a kind of a strange fit for me. But when you marry human rights and the work of An Garda Síochána, it's a perfect match, because you get to help people at the coalface. And the minute a person comes into contact with me in my uniform is one of the first times that they come into contact with a state apparatus. And that's where the I suppose, where the state and the person meets in a human rights aspect. And I really enjoy what I do. I'm a guard on the west coast of Ireland in Kilrush, down in County Clare. And I'm very, very passionate about helping young people through education, and not necessarily always formal education, even though that's a very important aspect, but through just learning how to make better decisions. And a lot of the young people that I would meet through my job are living either chaotic lives or in a crisis. If you have to come into contact with a member of an Garda Síochána Gána as a young person, you, a lot of the time you have encountered crisis. And that's, crisis is something that I'm very, very familiar with throughout my life. And I know how to solve problems in a very practical way, because people supported me through my crisis. And we can talk about that.
So thank you for that. And for, I think my listeners on this are roughly 50-50 Irish and outside. So for anyone who's outside, who the people in Ireland will be very, very familiar with An Garda Síochána. For people outside of Ireland, An Garda Síochána is the police force here in Ireland. Tell me about, so when you talk about your crisis, tell me about what that looked like, your own personal crisis.
Like I mentioned before, myself and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, we went travelling in 2005 and in 2006. And I found myself, we had always wanted to go to India. Hannah probably a little bit more than me. I tell you the truth, I was very anxious about going to India. And I remember the day that I stepped off the plane. I think it was sometime around the 22nd of September 2005. We'd just flown in from Africa. If you haven't been to India, I'll just paint a little bit of a picture. The heat in September, that time, September, October time in India is 30 to 40 degrees in Delhi. It's an assault on the senses. There's an amazing abundance of smells, aromas, and people everywhere. And it can be quite overwhelming. But we had checked into a 5-star hotel, which at the time was, you know, reasonably priced because it was in India, and we treated ourselves to 2 nights in a 5-star hotel because we'd spent a couple of months in Africa. And I was recuperating from the long haul flight and the jet lag, and I woke up and I remember the TV, the only service that they had that was in English was an American channel that was showing Oprah Winfrey, and they were talking about child abuse. And I watched it with intrigue, and at the end of the segment, there was a panel of men, and at the end of the segment, Oprah looked to camera and she gave a warning, or she just talked to camera that we have to remember that females are also abusers. We can't just say that men are abusers. And at that moment that Oprah said to camera that we have to acknowledge that females in our society are abusers, and if we need help, we need to get it. And I remember that so vividly because it hit me like a freight train. That is a cliche, but that is exactly what I felt. I remember I was curled up, I was clutching my knees, I was curled up kind of in the fetal position but sitting upright, and I just started bawling, crying. And I realised then that was my first flashback, real flashback, of what had happened to me when I was a child. I had been abused by a female who was looking after me. And it was quite surreal and quite serendipitous, as it happens when I look back, that we were in India. My girlfriend Hannah woke up and found me there. I don't remember how long I was crying, but she said that we need to go home because I was going through something, you know, quite terrible, and I needed help with this trauma. And by that evening, that was in the afternoon, and by that evening I had done what I was used to doing, which was I had buried those feelings back down to the pit of my being, because that's the only thing I knew how to do. Was, and it was obviously through therapy and through, you know, years of experience now, what I was actually doing was a very self-preservation protection mode, that I couldn't cope with the reality of what I was experiencing, because I was experiencing the abuse again in that moment of flashback. And why it was serendipitous that we found ourselves in India at this moment, I don't know it could have happened at any point in my life, this flashback. But I was in India. We soon went on to Nepal for 2 weeks, and we had flown back then at the start of October, I think. And we went to the north of India, a place called McLeod Ganj. It's near Dharamsala, and it's where the Dalai Lama lives in exile. And we had planned a 10-day meditation retreat in a Buddhist center. And it was quite profound that I had to sit only with the recent knowledge that I had been abused and face that head on while meditating, which was so helpful. Like, it is probably the one point in my life where if I was anywhere else, I'm not sure if I would have coped. I was with the one person that I trust wholeheartedly and love from my very being. And myself and my wife Hannah met when we were in school, and we're very, very much in love. And that's we met in 1996 when we were only children, but she supported me, and I sat with my feelings and I sat with that reality for the first time. And through guided meditation with a Buddhist nun called Robina Curtin, she's an extraordinary person. She's an Australian Buddhist nun, Venerable Robina Curtin. And through her guided meditations, I felt very, very supported, and I really explored my feelings. And a lot of what I learnt was taking control of my own feelings. And it was the start of the journey that I didn't accept until much later on in my life, but that was the start of my journey of not accepting the blame for what I experienced, because it wasn't my fault. So through the guided meditations, I used to picture the person that abused me, and then any of the feelings, negative feelings that I had, the guided meditation helped me to dismiss, basically. And it was a beautiful meditation that you, and if anybody is familiar with guided meditations, we were visualizing a yellow color on the inhale and a black smoke or a dark cloud leaving our body on the exhale. And it's really interesting as I look back and I think about it now. My job in the morning, we all had jobs. There was maybe 90 people on the course, a mixture of all different nationalities. And I think everybody was there for a reason. You really got in depth in conversations and meals. But my job every morning was to get up before everybody else and have a beautiful ritual of ringing the gong outside everybody's bedroom. And I just loved those memories. It was in the foothills of the Himalayas, in a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. And I was experiencing this trauma. And it's very serendipitous, really is. And I felt supported. Now, when I kept traveling, and I still pushed those feelings back down. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I actually dealt properly with my issues. Hmm. But
can I ask?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it's that to me is you've just described an incredibly kind of otherworldly and spiritual experience, what seems like, and you've mentioned the word serendipitous once or twice, and I think that those are the miracles that happen when we're open to receiving it. Like the fact that you sat in a room and the only English language channel was Oprah Winfrey, who herself is a very spiritual being, but talking about something that you needed to hear at that point in time. I'm always mesmerized by how those things happen, and they happen a lot. So can I ask, and feel free to say fuck off, I'm not talking about it, or I want to move on to something else, but like what did the abuse look like, or how long did it take place, or what? Because I think we hear abuse and both sides, I think a lot of people hear abuse and they almost kind of maybe don't want to go there, of what that is or what that means or what that meant, but If you're willing to share or talk about it, and I'm not forcing you to, please say no if you don't want to. But what was that like?
My first memory, like I said, was that flashback, and I suppose those memories had been there, but I just didn't I couldn't put a name on it, because I didn't believe, or it's not in our culture that women equate to abuse. And what that abuse looked like and what it felt like and what it was a very caring, manipulative, sexualized abuse, where the person coaxed me or manipulated me into touching her genitalia and kissing in a very, what it felt like at the time. I knew it was wrong. I was only a toddler. I was between the ages of 3 to 4, I reckon. And because it was such a, with the person that I obviously she had gained my trust, she was looking after me. And then in a way that was so sexualized that I didn't realize it wasn't violent in any way. And the fact that it was, the worst part of it for me was that I had experienced then a sexual experience that was very manipulative and very secretive. It made me feel guilt and shame that are also quite, we recognize those themes from other people who've talked about abuse. But it made me feel those things, and it was the secrets and lies and manipulation in that way, and that affected a lot of my relationship with all myself and the rest of the world for many, many years. It wasn't until I was in my adulthood, looking back, that I can say that. And I'm very open, as you can see, and very comfortable with talking about it, as comfortable as one can be about talking about it. Yeah. But because I'm on the other side of it, and what I've learned through my experience, those feelings of guilt and shame, they're not there as much as they were in my 20s, early 30s. But sometimes they raise their head, and I can feel guilty or shame or anxiety for a number of different triggers, but I have to remember that it wasn't my fault. And that I had no control over it. I had a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, a toddler basically, has no control over what they experience in that way. So those feelings, to answer your question, that's what it felt like, and that's what it looked like, and that's what it was, you know.
And thank you, because I know, like, I know you've said you're open to it. I know it can't be a comfortable thing to talk about, or that you would ever relish talking about it. So I'm privileged that you felt that you could. So thank you. You mentioned about the experience you had when this became clear to you in India, and that time in India, and the Truth of Meditation. But it was a few years later before you kind of fully explored it or dealt with it. What was that? How did you deal with it? Or what was, because I know you had you went to pretty dark places in that time. So talk a little bit about that.
What I had, now that I look back and understand what my behaviour was, I had pretty much hit the self-destruct button at that moment, or even probably a little bit before that moment in India where I had my first flashback. And if anybody is familiar with the feelings of guilt and shame, you blame every interaction on yourself. So when things go wrong, I blame myself. When something was outside of my control, I couldn't recognize it, and I self-harmed pretty much every day since then, in a way that is very subtle but very, very damaging. I didn't feel worthy of anybody's love. And while that's not a tangible, visual self-harm, it can be very, very damaging. And to the point where I did have visual and very public displays of self-harm, but it was by picking my fingers and making myself bleed when I was anxious or feeling shame or guilt. And I couldn't recognize that until I had explored my behavior and my feelings. And, you know, there was a lot of other things that I would push people away, to the extent that, because I didn't feel worthy of their love, or worthy of their care, I would push them away by having an argument and or being very hostile towards them in a very passive aggressive way sometimes. And again, the one thing that I was fearful of was being on my own. I was very needy, I would attach myself to people or friends and lean on them for support when they couldn't provide it. I didn't ask them to, I just put myself on them. And again, that kind of, I would term it a form of self-harm. Yeah. Because I didn't feel worthy of it. I didn't feel worthy of anybody's time. So I had to take it. And I couldn't be alone with my own thoughts for a long, long time because of those feelings. And again, a very destructive behaviour then comes out. And it ended up in a point in my life, 2012, when I was doing my master's. I ended up in a place, a very, very dark place, where I was experiencing panic attacks and just spiralling a lot. And instead of actually dealing with it, what I would do would be do all the stuff that was harmful to me. So I ended up being suicidal, where my feelings and that pain of the abuse and the shame and guilt was just too much to take. I couldn't bear it, and the only option that I saw was for me not to exist. I couldn't get rid of my experience. I couldn't go back in time and, you know, not experience it. And it was just overwhelming, to the point where one night I was living in an apartment on my own. I was having Hannah work together for a period, but she was still by far my best friend, who just supported me even when she couldn't, you know. And I want to not talk about that too much, because that part of my private life that I'd rather not go into. Just to say that Hannah is she's a remarkable person that loved me even when I couldn't love myself, and supported me from a distance. And I remember lying on my bed in my apartment in Rathmines on my own, and I was full to the brim. I was brimmed with pain, and I remember writing this very esoterical piece of writing. Just I was reading a lot of heavy politics and sociological theory at the time in college, and I put this quote on, I wrote a bit on Facebook and put it out to the world, and hoped that somebody would reach back. And I waited and waited, and eventually the phone rang, and it was my mother. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I think, and she was the exact person that I needed, that call from. My father had passed away years earlier, and I'm sure he would have supported me through it as well, but it was my mother that I really needed to speak to. And we made a plan, and she, as far as I remember, she came up on the train the next day, and she supported me through everything. And wow, that was really a massive turning point. And then I realised, I wondered how my mother had seen it, because I know my mother wasn't on Facebook at the time. Yeah. Hannah had actually seen the message and rang my mother and said, "You need to call him." And that support that I got, and then from my mother and from friends, was so profound, that what they made me believe was that I didn't need to do it on my own, and that the world really was a better place with me in it. And I needed to believe it. I needed to hear it, and I needed to believe it. And slowly but surely, through therapy and constant support from a handful of friends, there was other friends that I wasn't in contact with all the time, but did support me in other ways. And that's, I suppose, one thing that I've always been, you know, quite good at from being in school. Not being great at academic work in school, but we had a really, really close bunch of friends. And the support was just remarkable and amazing. Overwhelming to the point that a lot of it I couldn't take or couldn't believe, but the key people in my life, even when I was being really harmful to myself and really harmful to them, just listened and stuck by me. And yeah,
it's amazing. And it's like I have this love hate and honestly mostly hate relationship with the likes of Facebook.
Yeah,
like, you know, I'm fully cognizant of the potential benefits and the amazing connection that we get. I'm also, because a lot of my day to day is embedded in digital marketing communications and running ad campaigns and all that stuff, and like I feel like regularly selling, I'm just selling my soul to the devil bit by bit by bit by bit. But when you say that about like that was a powerful intervention, that Facebook acted as an intermediary to get you the support that you needed. And we don't hear that a lot, I think. And my experience was sort of similar in that I wrote a piece on medium.com on the 2nd of January 2017, and I pushed it out there on Twitter and Facebook. And that piece was the first, that piece, it brought unbelievable support to me in terms of friends that I was good friends with reaching out and speaking to me in a way that I'd never spoke, that we'd never spoken before. Like, including one of my best friends who said, you know,
it's good to have breaks in your recording anyway.
Yeah, it is. We can fix it up after. I'll fix it up after. If it bothers you, let me know. We'll find something.
No, not at all. Doesn't bother me at all.
So, including one of my best friends who reached out to me after he saw that and read that. I was like, you know, we'd known each other for 20 years, had drank together, gambled together. Like, you know, like we'd done the whole lot. We'd never spoken about stuff like that. And he was like, yeah, that's me too. Like, you know, we have really a very, very similar path, very similar experiences, but we'd never spoken about it to each other. And it also helped me, like it brought me to people. It brought people, like some of my best friends now saw that then. Like, but I didn't know them before that. So it was an amazing thing that what it helped me to do and helped me to achieve. So the parallels and what you spoke about just there are stark to me. You spoke about how there were those times where you felt that the pain was so much that you didn't want to be here. How close did you get?
That same night that I put that out on Facebook, I walked into the kitchen and put a blade against my wrist. And I'm not sure if it was before or after I spoke to my mother on the phone. But I had gotten that close where even the feeling of going to that point was a release. But I had my want to get to the bottom of why I felt like this was greater than the want not to live anymore. And part of it was that deep down I knew that I had these supports and I knew I wasn't on my own, because I'd been in therapy for a long time before that point and a long time after it as well. So I knew I didn't have to do this on my own. And that was one of the key things that allowed me to step back from it. Nobody was there. I could have gone through with it and I didn't. And there was another key moment where one of our closest friends, I was in his apartment going through a really bad crisis. It was the day before I met Ivor Brown, and I had done the same thing. I was in bed and don't remember going to the kitchen, but I came to kind of very like vividly with a blade against my wrist, and I had the piece of, I suppose, the wherewithal and the self-realization that I needed help. So I went straight into my body and I said, you need to take all the sharp objects away from me, because I'm in this moment right now and I don't know what I'm going to do. And he supported me, and what that support looked like was, he said, I can't remember exactly, but he said, "Oh, Robbie," because he calls me Robbie, and he hugged me, and he actually put me to bed. I remember him bringing me to the bedroom and just making sure I was okay and putting the quilt over me and said, "Don't worry, we're here." And that is the support that I got, and that if I needed it today, I'd still get it. Because I would do the exact same thing for my friends and family. And that's the key key relationship that you have with a support network, friends and family, basically. We call it a support network, but it's basically people you can call on that will make sure you're okay and listen to you. So he listened to me that day, and that's really, really powerful when you just listen.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ivor Brown, and he's somebody that I've never met, but I've read a number of profiles and interviews and some of his opinions, which would tally a lot with a lot of mine. I know I don't want to represent him because for fear of misrepresenting him, but I know he has pretty strong views on antidepressants, and the way they're used, and the way they're imposed on as treatments. But tell me about, like, he's like, you know, the doyen of, like, you know, when people think of I don't even know what his title is, but like when people think of mental health and positive mental health and treatment for, he's up there at the top of the tree in Ireland in terms of the work he's done, the cachet he has, the gravitas he has. He's somebody that everybody in this field, I think, would respect and look up to. I don't know how easy it is to get an appointment with him. How did that come about?
I was working with a therapist for about a year and a half before that point, and who works closely with Ivor from time to time, and she recommended that I see Ivor. And honestly, I don't know how else it came about, only to the point that I knew that to work with Ivor, I had to be willing to put in work as well. It's not a situation where I sit back and he did all the work. And that was the first discussion that I had with him. And in this moment of crisis, like I said, my Hannah and my best buddy drove me to Dunleary, and I had an appointment with Ivor. And the first thing he did, he's a great big tall man, over 6'4" maybe, or there. Anyway, he's if you've ever met Ivor, if anybody has ever met him, he's a very enigmatic gentleman. And but his philosophy on life is to do with the heart and love. And he hugged me. And for that experience between a professional and a client, I suppose, at that time, was a hug. It was, again, very, very powerful. And he just put it back on me to a point. He said, "I'll support you," but he gave me permission to end my life if I wanted to.
Did he say those words?
I can't remember if he said those exact words. And again, I wouldn't like to misquote Ivor, but that was the message that I received, which is the important bit, was that he said, "If you want my help, you have to stay alive. You can get my help only when you're here."
Yeah.
And he said, "I'll support you through it, but the deal is that you don't kill yourself." And I made a deal with him. And that permission, that I felt I was allowed to make that decision, became the most powerful communication that I had, you know. Mm. I knew it, but and you'll know it, but if anybody finds themselves in that moment, you know that you always have permission. But I also knew that I didn't have to do it alone. If I was alone in that moment, that's where my danger was. And I came up with a strategy that I could make a better decision if I felt like I needed to harm myself or I felt suicidal. The strategy was recognize that feeling, pick up the phone and ring my mother, my brother, or friend, some friends that I knew, they knew what I was going through. And not that it takes away the feeling, but it displaces it for that moment. And if you have enough moments throughout the day that you can displace that, then you can get through the day. Mm. And that is a fantastic tool of choice. It really is about choice. I chose to pick up the phone when I was feeling that bad and make a better decision. And again, if I couldn't get through to somebody, you always have to have a toolkit. And one of the things that I used to do as a way of trying to gain control, but never really succeeding, because I would call a friend that I knew I could go drinking with, and I'd go out and I was out of control, you know, by binge drinking, and you're completely out of control. So if I felt like that and I couldn't get through to anybody, my strategy was I would go to the gym, or I'd go for a walk, or I'd listen to music. And by the time I've ended that action, that positive action, I don't feel like I did before. So again, it's about displacing those bad those negative feelings, owning it, and going, I feel like that, but I'm going to do something positive, and maybe I'm not going to feel like that afterwards. So I go to the gym, and exercise makes me feel good. So inevitably, I didn't feel as bad as I did before I started. But I had to build in those mechanisms. It was hard. Like, if I had no strategy, that's when it became overwhelming. It was when I had a strategy that I had friends and family, I had activities that I wanted to do, and I had professionals that I could call on and make an appointment with and talk through it and support. And I pretty much went to everybody that I could think of that could support me in different aspects. And I went to the guidance counsellors in UCD. We put in strategies that I could complete my master's. I talked to my supervisors. I talked to some of my friends that were in college. So at every point throughout what I was doing that year, I would have support there. So I let one or two people know. I didn't let everybody know. But it was about making decisions.
And that takes a lot of guts. It feels like that takes a lot of guts to open yourself up to needing the support. And I'm not saying, I think it's essential, but it doesn't come easy to a lot of people. And I think that, like, as men, well, my experience, I'll say what my perspective is, and let me know if this tallies at all or if there's any overlap. But I have often felt, I'm a man, I need to be able to do this. I need to be able to do it. If I can't do it myself, well, then there's something wrong with me, or I'm less of a person. So to open myself up, that took, I think I had to hit that rock bottom moment and kind of go, I can't go any further, I can't go any lower and still be alive. But when I did open myself up, I realized, geez, like this is hugely powerful when I can talk to this person and talk to that person and have this honest conversation that kind of elevates us slowly and steadily over time. But do you recognize that, those feelings of kind of like, you know, I need to be able to do this myself?
Yes and no. I can identify it to a point. And I'll explain that I'd say I don't identify it greater than I do, because I was always great at asking for people's help and being really open.
Yeah.
But there's a really key learning in this, that I was asking people to do too much. I was asking my friends at a very young age to support me in ways that they just couldn't support me. I would open up in a very real way about things. And when you open up without asking the question, can you support me through this? And what support are you willing to give? Then you can end up, what I did was I ended up grasping onto friends and asking just too much, where to the point that they couldn't deal with my problems weren't their problems, and they didn't know how to help because they were big problems. And I used to get annoyed then when they pushed me at an arm's length. And again, there's a lot of people in this that I know through school and throughout my life that I did that. So I never wanted to do it on my own.
Okay.
But at a point when I asked, what are you willing to help with? And that's really important, because sometimes you just can't, when somebody opens up to you in a very real way with a really big problem, sometimes they don't know how to help.
Excuse me.
And it can be just too much. And that was my behaviour. And that's how I ended up without what I thought, I was on my own.
Sorry, Robin.
That's okay.
That was untimely. So the strategies that you have developed, does that feed into, because I want to talk about the Me app, I want to talk about what you're doing, and we come back maybe to the Gardaí Síochána and what the motivation, like, if there were experiences you've had in that environment, in your job, that have also motivated you in the Me app. But the strategies that you developed to help yourself at those points of crisis or those moments, are they is the motivation that you felt, or the results that you experienced from that, is that captured in the Me app? And it's a two-part question. The second part, which you can answer first, tell people about what the Me app is, what you're, because I know it's in development, it's something that you're working on, but tell people about what you're hoping that will be, and maybe come back to the bit that I asked about the strategies you've developed for yourself, is that represented in what you're hoping to work on or bring to the market?
Me is a social networking app that provides education for e-safety for young people to engage with, and it provides a response that is akin to the response that I had when I was going through my crisis. They're very practical responses, and when you and I learned how I can adapt them to pretty much any life situation, and it all begins with the permission. And we need to allow young people to have devices because it's part of our world, it's part of our modern world, and we need to allow them to have as much screen time as is necessary with the balance of other activities in our life, and teaching them to become better decision makers in that environment. And I've developed a toolkit based very much on my personal experience and also my professional experience as a guard. We in the Garda College, we partook in a suicide intervention training, which is so powerful. It's called Assist, and any member of our community can partake in and complete the course. One of the things that they teach you is, when I encounter somebody that is suicidal or is harming themselves, there are key things that I can say to that person to support them. And not only do I have the personal experience of that and know that it will actually work, and now I have the professional experience in the capacity of my work as a guard, that when somebody is in crisis and they are suicidal, and I've met them either on a bridge ready to jump or in their home where they've been harming themselves to the point where at any moment they could take their own life, naming it is one of the most important things. Are you suicidal? And that opens up the discussion. And then the key things that I've learned is that making a plan and listening to the person about how they want help is key. And 100% of the time, it has worked. And it's about, if I can, connect that person to a person that they can trust. And I always ask them before I enter into a discussion is, can you trust me? That's really powerful. It's not, we don't say trust me, because I don't know, that person doesn't know if they can trust me. That has to be, you know, a discussion. So I always say, can you trust me? And it's very powerful when I'm standing there in uniform, being very empathetic to the situation, listening, and then suggesting a support mechanism. And I always say, can I make a plan with you? Would you be willing to make a plan with me to get help for you? The person always says yes, because they want help. So I will first try and get in contact with a member of somebody, a friend or family that can come to the scene and help them. Or that we can at a point where the person feels safe enough that we can transfer care from me as a guard to a family member. And if there isn't anybody that we can call, it's very important that I get the person's permission to bring them to a medical intervention. And when I met young people then coming to the Garda station in crisis with online problems, they were encountering difficulties, either online bullying, abuse, very common, probably not reported as much as we think, would be naked pictures going viral online. And parents and young people are very worried about this scenario, and they come to the guards for help. And sometimes it's what's going on, the behaviour, it doesn't reach the threshold of criminality. And it's very hard to reassure somebody that has come to the police service for help. We deal with criminality, but the Guards is a great organisation for community work. We have an 80% trust level within our communities. And our biggest tool is our ability to talk to people without the intervention of, or without implementation of legislation. And that's a beautiful thing, because at the end of it, whether it's a friend, a family, a member of an Garda Síochána or a police service, or some a psychologist or a psychiatrist, the help that people want and need is people-to-people interaction. People forget that when we talk about state bodies, either the police service, education, and in this sense, the medical services. That help, at the end of the day, is somebody sitting next to you, providing advice, professional advice. And that's the help that we need. At the very first interaction, if you can give that person support, it's a really good thing. So when I've met young people, I started implementing what I learned. If I didn't have the legislation to help them, because sometimes it just isn't there. You know, there's no legislation to deal with online bullying. And sometimes, even if it can be implemented, it's not always helpful, because it's usually peer-to-peer. And sometimes it's not in the public interest to prosecute another young person for online bullying. So I looked at it practically, and I remember going to a few different incidents late at night where a young person was looking for help because they were experiencing severe bullying online on multiple different platforms, and up to tens of or hundreds of abusive messages in a very short period of time. So what we want to do is we want to take the phone away. But what I realised by listening to young people is we're taking away their communication to their peer supports. And if we remember when we were young, we are risk takers. But sometimes our first support systems are our friends. Sometimes we're not going to tell, for the most part, we're not going to tell our parents that something has happened online, because the parent has said, give me that phone, don't be online so much. But the reality is that young people, that's where they communicate. It's not outside in the green anymore. It's not out on the street like we did, probably Shane growing up, yeah. You know, playing football or whatever. It does. There is a part of our life that still is that. But you can't say to a young person, come offline, when that's where their friends are hanging out and that's how they're communicating. So by taking away the very device that is giving them their first line of support, we need to allow them to make a better decision, like I learned when I was in a crisis. Is, of course, if you don't look at it, it doesn't exist. And I say to the young person, is there any way you can come off that social media platform for a period of time so you can give yourself the breathing space so it doesn't damage you? And more often than not, they say no, it'll make things worse. So what I do is I make, with the young person's permission, is see if they have friends, one or two very close friends that they have in school, because when we talk to our friends, we will feel better. Even if you're talking about not this, you don't have to open up about what's going on, but you do something that you enjoy doing with your friends. That's what we all want to do. We want to hang out with our friends all the time and do fun things. And a lot of the activities that you do are, you know, things that have real experience, real experiential value and learning. And, you know, you can bring it down to sport, or you can, any activity that learn, that teaches you how to fail, how to persevere, and how to succeed. Because succeeding comes confidence. Resilience is built in the journey of learning, because you will fail at some point, you will fall over, but they need to know that they're allowed to make those mistakes in a safe environment. And when they have that permission, they're not going to always want to be online. They're going to want to be where their friends are at. You're interacting in something else, probably human to human interaction, or it doesn't always have to be. You can like listen to music, or, you know, play a game online, because there's a lot of benefits from online activity that I suppose adults are fearful of. But if you know how to recognize the dangers, there's nothing to be fearful of, because you can recognize it. Communicating with other human beings, that's not bad for you. Hmm. Communicating with your peers and communicating with your friends and your family and learning how to communicate properly is not bad. We need to stop having so much fear. Because the majority of young people, the majority of the time, are safe. They're quite savvy in it. When you talk to young people, they know what to do. But the problem is that the education system that we're rolling out, if we look at today, like let's say we look at the problems online, and we sit down today, Shane, and we look at all the problems, and we go, how can we solve all these problems? And we devise a really fantastic educational program for e-safety. It'll more than likely take about a year for us to roll it out and implement it. But the thing here is that the environment online is changing so quickly that our education system will more than likely be out of date. So we'll reduce it back to don't spend so much time online. Be wary of who you're talking to. Be careful about the information that you're sharing. And parents are really worried about sending naked images. We always tell our young people, don't do that. And it's all about don't do this, don't do that. But the thing is, remembering that we're always risk takers. So there is a want in us as humans to do what we're not allowed to do. So you take the risk, you engage in the behavior. But the point is that what do we do then when it goes wrong? And that's why young people end up in a guard station going, what do I do? This person, it's gone viral. This picture of me has gone viral. I'm the laughing stock. I want to end my life. Like, in synopsis, it's more complex than that.
Yeah.
But at that point, my job then, and our job as a society, is to make sure that the person has supports. Because if I can get through a suicidal period in my life with the most heinous of crimes committed on me when I was a toddler, you can get through anything. But we need to allow, and that permission and that education we need. And again, when I looked at the problems, I engaged with the education that's out there. I engaged with the platforms that are problematic. One of the biggest problems is that young people aren't engaging in the education in the way we want to. Because there's no point in telling 70 to 100 students at the start of the school year, now lads, don't do this online. We're forbidding you to do this. We're actually going to ban the phones on school premises. So we're telling you, don't communicate with anybody online. It's bad. But there's no point in telling the person that when they don't need that information. If you're not in crisis, you're not able to relate to that. I thought, how do we get information to young people in a better way? And I'm a man that thinks of working with something rather than against it. So there's a lot of information there and a lot of great statistics and really rich data coming from great organisations. And what it's telling us is that young people, younger and younger, are having devices and they're engaging in riskier and riskier behaviour, but they're not engaging with the education. So what do? We bypass all of that, put the education on the phone, and we encourage them to have a balance, and we give them permission to make that decision. The app is encouraging them to have a safety toolkit right on their device. And believe, it's called Me because we need to believe that we are all capable of making better decisions. And who do we identify most with? Ourselves. Me.
The solutions to technology's problems are going to, lots of the solutions are going to come via technology.
Correct.
So the technology is not going away. In fact, it's going to get more powerful and more stronger. I saw the recent video about Google's new quantum computer thing, and it's like we're at ground zero of what the technology is going to look like in, you know, another 5, 10, 20, 50 years. So the idea of banning the technology is, you know, real head in the sand type stuff. So I definitely think, like, so to me, you're definitely on the right track, and I'm really interested in seeing where this goes. In terms of that toolkit, what does that framework of support and education, what does that, and I know that the app isn't live, so it's not ready for people to download, experiment, try, but what's your vision for what that looks like? When a kid or a teenager picks up that phone and the app is on there, what can they expect when they open it up?
This is also part of, you know, solving the problem is there's no point in providing education halfway through the journey. We don't educate, you know, we don't teach people how to drive a car after 5 years of them having a car.
Yeah.
So if you hand a person a device that you need education with, then it needs to be there at the start. So when a child for the first time has their own phone and engages with it, the first platform that they engage with is Me. And in this case, themselves. They're engaging with themselves, because the options will be to build a support network. And again, when we talk about support network, it's just people, friends, family. And for, let's say, the statistics are saying between 8 and 13 is when a young person gets their first phone. At that age, the majority of that person's support environment are their their parents and their friends, and maybe other extended family, but definitely it will start with their family. So when they open it up, they will put their mom and dad or their caregivers into their guardians into the app, and they know then that this is what I'm calling at the moment a safe list, but it's really a support network. And then on from that, they're teaching the app what interests they have, and you can change it throughout your experience. But let's say we're interested in, a young person is interested in outside activity like football, horse riding, swimming, something like that, they put that in. But maybe they're interested in online activities as well, which is really important to include. So they're in, they like Minecraft or online gaming, so they can put that in there. And then their experience is engaging with e-safety education, which is one of the key things. But young people don't want it. We don't want information all of the time, every day. We just need it. We want to engage with it when we need it.
Just in time.
Yeah. Mm. And but to recognize what bullying looks like, and the education, as I envisage, will be a mixture of audio, visuals, illustrations, animations, and moving image to cater for all aspects of learning styles. And it'll be very simple. Recognize the danger, and then the response, like we talked about before, is that when you're in crisis, maybe you don't need to talk to your safe list or your support network, but maybe you just need to displace that. You don't need to look at the bad stuff that you're experiencing. So bullying, take bullying, because everybody, that's a very tangible and very problematic situation. You can't control what somebody else is doing, but you can control what your response is. In the same way as I couldn't control what I experienced as a child, but I could control my response. And that's a really key learning from a child's perspective, is that they do want to be safe. They want to know that they can explore the environment in a safe way. So the recognize bullying, what that looks like in an illustration or an animation, moving image, text, and then the response. If this happens, you can call somebody if it's really bad, or you can engage in a music, you can engage in a game that displaces that bad for a period of time, and then it will encourage the individual to make a plan akin to suicide prevention. But making a plan doesn't have to be as drastic, but making a plan, like we do this every day anyway, we make plans with our friends and family to do things, and it will encourage them to make a plan to do something that's good and positive for them. And it could be as simple as going to the football match, going to the rugby match, or playing the game, but you're going with friends. And the everyday use of the app is a private photo sharing library. I'm going to ask you to do me a favour, okay? Yes, a little bit of experiment, if you don't
let's
mind.
Let's do it.
Okay, Grant, because I've talked for a long time there. Think about a time in your life where you had a difficulty, and you mentioned it throughout the interview. Now, I want you to think of two or three people that supported you. Now, what I want you to do is take out your phone, open up your photo gallery. You don't need to show me.
Yep.
Find a picture of one of those people that supported you. Are you thinking about that bad time in your life?
No.
No. What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about my wife.
Do you want to talk to her after this interview?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're smiling.
Yep.
And you're doing something that you do anyway, but I'm reducing the friction and the barriers to it. So even by the very action, you did it just there and you saw the benefit of it. But when we look at pictures, we only share a 20% of our lives on social media platforms. And young people do the same. They're the very same. When I've talked to them, they're the very same. But it's 2 o'clock in the morning when I've had a bad call in the station and I'm sitting there and I'm debriefing in my own head. I opened up my I was doing this before I even thought of the app. I was doing this. I was opening up my photo gallery, and I was looking at photos and videos of my wife and my child, because they made me feel good. And the most honest, and it didn't just make me feel good, it connected me to my very being. I pride myself on loving my family, and I love being a father, and I love being around my daughter. She is, and every father or mother will probably have the same experience. But when you look at photos of them, you feel fantastic. It connects you to that lovely feeling of just being who you are. In that space. And that's the it's a private photo sharing gallery. So when, let's say we make a plan, and it's not, you don't need to be in a crisis to make a plan with a friend. And the photo gallery is called Me and You. So Me and You make a, we've made a podcast today, okay? And after it, I could send you a photo. I say, really enjoyed this. This was fantastic. And I'll send you a picture of us both, let's say. And that's all it has to say. And you don't have to say anything back. Just sit in your library until you need it again. And that's one of the responses as well. So it's about connecting with people in a real and meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
And encouraging better decisions. And knowing that young people will take risks. And they will find themselves in a crisis. But it's not so much of a crisis if they know how to get support from family, building their confidence and resilience, and connecting with themselves.
I'm familiar at an arm's length distance with software and how software gets from concept to reality. Where are you at in this now? What stage of development is Me, the Me app, in? And we come back, I'm interested in the business model, like how are you going to support it and sustain it?
So it's in demo at the moment. I've had it at demo stage for a little while now. And the next part of it is, I've been getting it in front of people who've been trialing it for me for the last number of weeks. And the next step is that I need to raise €75,000 through Kickstarter to build it and sustain it for about a year and a half. And people might think that that's quite a hefty sum of money, and it is.
I know it can disappear very quickly in software.
It can. Mm-hmm. But here's what the benefit from that €75,000 is. I don't want 7 people or 10 people to give me €7,500. I want 7,500 people to give me €10.
Mm.
Because at the end of the day, that this is a social movement. It's recognizing that we are all our best line of defense when we have the education that we need. And that parent-child relationship needs to be nurtured.
Yeah.
So it's a social movement, starting with young people and parents. And when I get the 75,000, it will enable me to build it. And after the first version, I can make it better. A lot of those funds will go back into making the app better once I know how people are using it every day and listen to their feedback. And then the rest is, because I'm working on my own, I'm outsourcing different parts. The educational piece is going to be one of the biggest parts of it. And I'm outsourcing that, so I need to pay for that. And one of the biggest developments that I want to integrate is AI, or artificial intelligence, as part of the learning mechanism and supports. I want the app to learn what is risky or dangerous for the individual, and then learn with the user or the individual about how, what responses work for them. So it's again reducing the barriers and the friction between the person and the supports that they need, and making it seamless. Because once it's seamless, and once the artificial intelligence can be used for good, the person has a nicer, more enjoyable experience online.
Mm.
And instead of this fear that we have as parents and a social anxiety about technology, then it will just become a nicer, better place to be. What I will say is that at the start of this, I'm not motivated by money. I love my job. I love my family. And if nothing out of my life ever changed, I would be a very, very happy man. Because I know now what really connects me to myself and to my family. It's my family and friends. And I've found a way that I love my job, and I go in there every day looking to help people. And if this is something that just exists in the world, brilliant, fantastic. And I want to keep that integrity and honesty in it, that this should exist to help people. And I don't want to price people out of it. I don't want it to become a product where there is, at one point, a person who needs it and can't afford it. I never want it to be that way. Because at the end of the day, if somebody came into the Garda station and spoke to me personally, it's the advice that I would give them for free. Because it's my social and duty to work in the community and give that advice. So I just want this to exist. And I want people to believe in it. So what I'm looking for, my ask is for 7,500 people to believe that a tenner is going to actually build this. Please, please contribute in that way. And together we'll make a better online environment for everybody.
I wish you all the very best. Shane here again, very briefly, just before we take off. Thank you, first of all, so much for listening all the way to the end. I'm super aware that 1 hour plus podcasts are not possible for everybody to listen to. Time is our most precious asset. And if you've made it all the way to the end here, clearly it's because something in this resonated with you. If that is the case, I'd be very, very, very happy if you could share this with your network in whatever shape or form that is, whether that's email, whether that's word of mouth, talking to somebody at the bus stop, telling somebody at the water cooler, posting on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever it is, take screenshots and post it out there and help me spread the word. If this message that we spoke about in this episode about Robin's work and about technology and younger people and vulnerability, if any of that resonated, please do spread the word. You can find all the other episodes of the Life While Live podcast. There are 21 previous episodes. They are all available on my website, shanebreslin.com. If you visit shanebreslin.com/podcast, you will see all the archives there. We have had lots of interviews over the last year. I've enjoyed every minute of the time spent putting this together. The mission of the Life While Live podcast is to provide support, guidance, and inspiration that anybody might need to overcome any life challenges, to embrace your once in history uniqueness, and ultimately to live a life of vitality, fulfillment, contribution, and happiness. So thank you once more for listening to this podcast. I look forward to connecting with you in the future and talk to you soon. Bye bye.